I'm Femi Oke. You're watching the Stream Bonus Edition. Today, actors and artists whose work is inspired by current affairs. I'll be revisiting some of the special moments when we dimmed the studio lights and turned this face into a stage. Coming up, the South African decolonization movement that spread around the world and the Israeli actress and director whose support of Palestinian rights brought death threats and censorship. We start with three black Muslim spoken word poets, Tariq Touré, Sadia Bashir and Muhammad Tor.
Listen to my heart go. Boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap. God made it do that. God made it do that. God made it do that. Do that. Do that. Boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap. Capitalism wants to put an end to that. That's God in me. Because to them, God is wealth. But God himself ain't never been dollar bill green. I've seen politicians baptized in false dreams. But I've been graced with sight keen enough to see past the facade and recognize God. That's because I've been graced with the spirit of Fidel. Ready to castrate my ghetto with the Castro and my falsetto. Waging war against minimum wage with the rage of Fela Kuti and the Kufi. Witnessing the bloody aftermath capitalism leaves behind. And when you're left behind, the machine says you're fine. Then it takes your struggle and it tries to refine. Like sugar, it's a domino effect. God bless how we resurrect, then take our bones and add to the shrine. How divine death must be. That's what the poor man, who used to be the floor man, before he was a four man, before blacks were whole man, he knew he was a whole man. He needs somebody to hold man. They held him down and hold man. Square. Cops never cared. So today he gotta hold hands and pray. Like Che Guevara fighting terror. Saddam's mom reading the Quran for me. Some say dying while fighting should be an honor to me. But them people ain't really down for the cause. Cause if they could, they put me down for the cause. Just because. Then they'll ask Malcolm how come. And he'll say with a grin like Martin. Muhammad should have known that the marksmen already marked him. Men who speak against the invisible cage are marked men. The invisible hand left Karl Marx with marks around his neck. Asphyxiated flesh fills cotton fields. I feel filled with cotton. How does white man keep me picking on myself? See, I might have caught 10 if I never caught on to the boast of the Gold Coast. Kwame Nkrumah removing the tumor. Eurocentric temptress attempted to make black men their own prison for profit. Now all our profits in prison. Mandela's medallion keeps my smile living, even though they tried to annex my chest. So I make sure that I'm always Teflon vested, Cornell West kid, came from the West Side, living in the West End, Mal Smith and West End, gun butt the government, tell them that I'm mental, tell them that I'm mental. This poem right here was made to dismantle the invisible cage.
You are at a point where you are influencing younger poets out there, but I want to talk about how you got started, because I know there was a point in your life where you were told you weren't good enough to be a poet.
Definitely. In high school, I was attending a school, and basically they didn't think I had what it took to compete for spoken word in a specific competition. A year later, I transferred schools, and we had a theater arts class, and the drill for that day was to tell a story. And it didn't matter which medium we chose, we just had to tell a story. And I remember a year ago, I wrote a poem. And I said, I was comfortable in the class, everybody loved me. I was like, let me share this poem with y'all. And when I shared it, everybody went crazy.
What happened?
They just went crazy. Like, everybody was like, oh, yo, that's hot, that's hot. Like, it was a very, like, diverse group of young people. Uh-huh. And it just took off from there. My mentor at the time, Jacob Mayberry, he heard about my performance, and he came and met with me after class, and he said, I want you to come to our poetry club on Thursday. And so when I went to the poetry club, I performed the same poem. And he was like, congratulations, you're on the Baltimore City Youth Poetry Team.
Ooh.
And a year ago, Sadia was telling me, you need to join this team. You need to sign up. You have what it takes. And I was like, nah, I don't think I have what it takes. So as soon as we left the room, I ran to the bathroom, and I called Sadia. I was like, yo, I'm on the Baltimore City Youth Poetry Team.
For when my niece grows up with too much backbone for men to kneel before her stand and a tongue as sharp as fire, and she asks me, Auntie, what do you do with skin that screams terror? I will tell her, write Cause I'd be well too ignorant to tell you not to, sister. You a soldier. Siphon the melanin in your skin for ink. So join your truth. But know that they will come for you. Even when you're too broke to buy a stamp to send for them. And their privilege will try to take all the letters off of your page to write their legacy. And once there is no more ink, their privilege will say, well, I don't see color. So ask God to make you of ink, for when you are broken and bloody from them, you can rewrite your legacy by tenderly caressing your skin, because my, there's an angel in you. And God sent you a book that rhymes so that you could define the divine in you. Name one of our prophets who wasn't a poet, whose tone was more of suns to shine for you. And she will ask me, what kind of poetry does your skin love to recite? And I will tell her, I'm into writing poems that breathe like survivors, for writers never die. We make heartbeats out of syllables and an eternity out of semicolons. For when my niece grows up with too much backbone for men to kneel before her stand and a tongue as sharp as fire, and she asks me, Auntie, what do you do with skin that screams terror? I will tell her, let it be heard. For your skin is the most supreme spoken word.
The words of Sadia Bashir. Our community is responding. Amiha says the two things that Sadia always puts an emphasis on are speaking your truth. I think you just heard her do that. And not ending your poems in victimhood. With her help, I've been able to take and bring a level of rawness and poetry to empower to my poetry, which didn't exist before. And another person writes in that she's had the pleasure of watching Sadia perform and says that she loves it because for me, it was the first time as a Black Muslim that I saw part of myself reflected in poetry. Femi.
Sadia, do you feel that you have an extra responsibility that the gentleman on either side of you don't have? You're all representing. But then you're representing up here.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah?
I feel like it's just kind of like you already have a responsibility as a Black person. You already have a responsibility as a Muslim. And then I'm a woman. So it's like I have that responsibility as well. This isn't to take away from the fact that, you know, they have their own intersections. But, yeah, I feel like I have a responsibility to represent all of my voices.
I found God in a bean pie. I've seen Kufis placed atop the heads of felons whose smiles could swallow the Mississippi. I've witnessed the crackling Morse code of Tesbih, double for a life raft. Watched Dua incinerate a suicide note. The Islam I know turned Melba the dope fiend to Mariam the philosopher, Malcolm the animal, two Shabazz. Ships set sail in the name of Isa, Jesus, Jesus, prophetic nouns inscribed on the broadside of vessels, blessed by the highest councils in the land, human cargo aborted to the land to turn souls into profit, with the lavender-faced children of Muhammad in its belly. Back and forth on the Atlantic's throat, a mother raising her shackled hands to the heavens to beg Allah deliver his name until the famished mouths of her family fallen once again into chains. And we proclaim their Shahada in the same position. Distant mother, I hope you'll see that the Adhan is the 808 drum still shaking us to the atom. That sujood has dignified our posture yet again. Know that a third of this nation's children are Black like you. Bold like you. Regal like you. That kinked hair falls in the spines of Qurans and valleys and mountaintops. We have never had a home here, but Lord knows we can turn a bando into paradise. Lord knows we can turn lemons into la ilaha illallah. Your down payment, just enough for us to buy our Molana's religion in cold cash. You should see we've made space here. Baba's Arabic gorgeously broken over a southern twang. Sora Nas under a northern bebop. Can't shake the jazz out our step. Can't peel the boom bap off our lips. For us, this has always been about burning Master's house to the ground and dancing in the ashes. A stadium full of our ancestors looking on. This theology has always been about a solstice of justice, a parade of freedom marching through the soul, a return home. So one day the giver of light sees the light on our faces, sees us for our faces, and welcomes us back beyond the veil.
Sephora says, how do we move Black Muslim poets out of the niche category and have it seen as a fully Muslim or Islamic poetic form of expression? And I would also say mainstream then. How do you make this mainstream? Do you think there is a way, or does it need to be? Tariq?
I think our responsibility as poets, and definitely with these two phenomenal people next to us, to Sister Sephora, I would say that our job is to continue writing. And the people who produce the shows, we'll work with them to see if we can get platform more. But our job is to write and convey as authentically as possible. And that should be our focus. As far as a niche category, our Islam is also rooted in expressing our experiences in coming to Islam and being Muslim and all of that. And all of those things are intertwined. My mother, she became Muslim by becoming a part of, you know, Black Liberation Movement and things like that, and being interested and deeply involved in trying to find herself in a society that didn't want her. And then she became Muslim because that was the answer for her. So they can't be detached. For me, it isn't particularly a niche. So, yeah.
You can catch up with the latest from Tariq via Twitter at Tariq Touré. Sadia can be found at Ida B. Wellin. That's at Ida B. Wellin. And Muhammad's Twitter handle is at FreshcutMo. Back in 2015, students at the University of Cape Town campaigned to have a statue of the controversial politician Cecil Rhodes brought down. The Rhodes Must Fall protest was so successful, they energised a global discussion about how to decolonise education. Some of the students who were involved in the original protest dramatised their story in a theatre production called The Fall. It was a hit in South Africa and everywhere it toured. When the cast visited the stream, we talked about the play and how they became student activists.
I was on the drama campus of UCT, so we were very separate from the main body of the campus. And I remember there was talk of someone who had thrown poo on the statue, and we were very interested in knowing what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I looked on my phone and I saw on Twitter and on Facebook videos of this guy and all these people standing around the statue. And for some reason, I was with a few of my friends who are in the play as well, and we felt drawn to the situation. There was a rush of adrenaline where we felt this is the moment that we have been waiting for. And we abandoned classes, and we went to the Bremner building where there was a meeting held, and that's where everything started, where people said, okay, well, if you're not going to tell us when the statue's going down, then we're going to occupy this building.
Yeah. And this is the Cecil Rhodes statue, which is on the campus of the University of Cape Town. And it was a bucket of poo that was thrown at Cecil Rhodes' statue. And Amira, for you, this was an education process to work out what had this guy done that made some University of Cape Town students so furious about his presence there.
Yeah, for a lot of students, I think we weren't really aware of what the legacy of Cecil John Rhodes actually was, because it's not really something that you get taught about at high school level. It's only if you actually pursue history into university, maybe second or even third year, do you really start learning about the actual rot of colonialism, as the tweeter had said. So for me, it was, you know, okay, people are really reacting to this statue, to this moment. Why don't I know about this? What can I do to seek out this knowledge? And really, the only place that you could get the information was the movement. And it was amazing to be part of that moment where it wasn't only, as a lot of people thought it was, just this like angry bunch of students occupying buildings, knocking down things, you know, being annoying to the staff members. There were also film screenings that were held. There were lectures with the Black academics that were held. There was information that was passed around to people, and it was really like a separate university to the university, which was amazing.
Siswe, what was it about this moment? Why 2015? Why not the year 2000? Why not last year? What was it about that particular time?
I think it was time. I think, you know, the stars aligned and 2015 was that year. And I'm fortunate to be part of that group of 2015 because it was such a big symbol. The actual removing of the statue was such a big symbol that, you know, we had that power to remove the statue. So, yeah, 2015 is the year, you know. I don't know why it was 2015,
right.
But it's 2015, and that's when, you know, our lives changed.
This movement belongs to all of us. It belongs to a whole lot of groups involved with transformation at the university, like the Trans Collective. I'm non-binary, I'm in that. Imbizo, Black Monday, the Black Academics Caucus, the Workers' Union, the SRC. I'm in that too. When our comrade Kumani threw human excrement on the statue of Rhodes, he was at a loss for words about how crap it is for university students at this university. In fact, throwing some poo on the statue was 100% articulate. It's amazing, really, how so many people got lit about some poo on a statue, but some very hard work was going on around transformation long before he did that.
No,
Keres, please, we need to talk about the statue. Hand.
Guys, I'm a little confused. Doesn't management want the statue to be taken down? I mean, aren't they just following due process?
Due process? Yeah, my sister. We all know the history of Rhodes. His statue on our campus traumatizes us. That man never wanted us here.
Yeah, ne? Cecil John Rhodes. I learned about him in my second year African history course. It was then that I realized that the history we were learning was not the history of Africa, but rather the history of how Britain and the Western powers stole Africa and carved it up into little countries, with people like Livingstone, Leopold, and Rhodes featuring as heroes. You see, Rhodes didn't only wrap up the Kimberley diamond mines for himself or a couple of his buddies, thank you very much. He was an arch-imperialist who believed 100% in the superiority of the English race. You know, all I learned about Africans was how weak we were. Weak in weaponry, travel and clothing, how we had to be civilized by the great Christian nations. I mean, what kind of history is that? And they say he donated this land to the university. But whose land was it to begin with?
The story of being black and writing history is not complete without addressing the most marginalized in society. You know, people like black people, women, and then the struggle goes on to queer bodies, non-binary caters, like we saw one of the non-binary caters in the sketch that people just saw now walking out. People who have disabilities. Our image is not complete until all those people are also empowered, feel like they can participate and can contribute into the movement.
You know, as we have the privilege of taking the show internationally right now, but we definitely weren't like the architects of the movement. But it's a great thing that a movement in South Africa was able to influence so many other universities. I remember when the shutdown happened, and we also had a lot of universities supporting us, shutting down their universities because they're supporting South African universities in shutting down. So it's incredible. Also, the use of social media has helped the movement so incredibly much. It's connected so many voices that are going through so many similar things across the world and across campuses for us to be like, oh, so we're not the only, it's not crazy to feel the way that we feel, and we're not the only people feeling this. So it's a great feeling to know that people that are in these institutions are not there to just absorb information. It's like, no, we're done with that. We are here to change the narrative. We are here to make sure that when we have children and they go into these institutions, they're not necessarily going through the same problems that we're going through, that they're there to learn. Because oppression in all types of forms, it disturbs you. It takes away so much of your time, so much of your heart, so much of your energy. You know, in areas where you could be growing as a person, that is like stunted because you're constantly having to validate yourself in
situations where you really shouldn't have to, especially considering the fact that we're in Africa. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, we're the majority. We are in Africa, at the bottom of Africa. But yet, a lot of the times, it doesn't feel like that. And I was just going to refer to something that Gore said about Cape Town. Cape Town is... it's a beautiful city to look at aesthetically, but it's very problematic. And I'm not surprised at the fact that the University of Cape Town, because it's firstly, it's very hard to get into that university, and it's very diverse, which is a beautiful thing, but there's not enough representation, and it's in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And it just shows the type of environment that, you know, we live in. And yeah, I'm just glad that it's been able to influence other universities, and then that name has stuck, because a lot of things need to fall.
The cast and creators of The Four, chatting to me and Malika Bilal back in 2018. Now, we had to split the conversations into two episodes, so we had enough space at the desk to speak to all seven performers, but they were definitely worth the effort. Finally, the potent impact of political theatre. The play Shame 2.0 explores the challenges of being an activist and artist in Israel. It tells the true stories of Israeli playwright Einat Weizman and Palestinian actor Murad Hassan. In this excerpt from the production, Colleen Delaney plays the role of Einat, and then the real Einat joins the stream from Tel Aviv.
Sometimes it's the little decisions that make all the difference. That sunny morning in 2006, I chose a T-shirt from my closet. It was a political statement, of course, but it was also a rather naive one. What started out as a torrent of abuse from members of the internet public went on to push us to perform this little play, Shame, which led to others. What I didn't know then was that these voices of public abuse weren't merely fringe voices, but would go on to become the voice of the mainstream. That my plays would be heatedly debated in Parliament. That the government would push for laws to try and stop me as a friend to terrorists. And so my personal transformation from T-shirt wearer to playwright is also the story of the radical descent of my country. While despairing, the worsening and critical situation in Gaza and in all other parts of Palestine. For Israeli artists, for my country that I love, there is also a little hope that art, even if stumbled upon by hazard or chance, can make a difference.
I was just thinking, Einat, at your Facebook page, and that quote is on your Facebook page and on a poster here. There's also a little hope that art, even if stumbled upon by hazard or chance, can make a difference. What difference is your art and Murad's art making?
I think that the most a good example for what the importance of art is the loyalty law that the Minister of Culture was trying to pass in the Israeli parliament, a law that that every artist should be loyal to the states, and if not, funds will be taken from him. So I think this law that Miri Regev was trying so hard to pass is like testifying to the importance of art, because if there is a need to a whole government and pass a new law in order to fight against a playwright or a poet or a Palestinian institution, that means that power in that art indeed has power. And I think that the struggle here is about narratives and about perception. And I think that art has its role together with history, with the media, with politics, law. So, yes, so I believe in art.
That wraps up our show for today. Thanks for watching. See you next time.